Last Word on Today FM.
All right, time for the last word in the environment. John Gibbons is with us. John, good evening. How are you keeping?
Good evening, Will.
Plenty for us to talk about. Particularly, there is a report which has come out about sea levels and particularly the impact that could happen here in Ireland. So the analysis looked at every air code across Ireland and essentially, if there was to be an extreme coastal event, which we can talk about the definition of that in a second, there are more Irish homes which are at risk than previously.
That's right. The particular study has identified approximately 104,000 homes at risk of flooding. So that's about heading for 5% of our total stock. And what's really worrying about this is that they identified that quite a few of these homes have been built recently, right? So in full knowledge of rising sea levels, in full knowledge of climate change and coastal surges, we're still building housing in the wrong place. And of course, there's huge pressure, as we all know, to build and nod through housing, and local authorities are under pressure. Everyone's under pressure, but we cannot be building in the wrong places. This is the critical thing to come out of this. And for example, there's been, as you know, Will, quite a clamour in certain quarters in recent years that we should turn the Dublin Docklands into a new city. It'd be fantastic. It'd be right there in the city centre. It's, you know, we could move the Dublin Dock maybe up to Dundalk, build a new city there. It's a very compelling idea, very, very tempting idea. But the snag is that Dublin Docklands are among the areas that have been identified as being at high risk, including the East Wall, have been at high risk of ongoing flooding. And what we're looking at here, I suppose, are the exceptional events. And when you're planning and when you're building, you don't build for the sunny day. You build for the stormy day. You have to build resilience that looks at what's the worst that could happen in the next 5, 10, 20, 50, 100 years.
Because, so how likely is an extreme event then?
Well, the first thing, of course, to say about that is that the so-called once-in-a-century weather event, that term has been officially retired because that term was developed against a stable climatic background. Now, what you have to do instead is to look at what are the risks. So the typical 1 in 100 year event, what you find with climate change, depending on the type of event, might now be a 1 in 15 year event, a 1 in 10 year event. Now, obviously, if a catastrophic sea level rise or coastal inundation event were to happen once every 10 or 15 years, you could be talking about an event with financial impacts, never mind the distress that it causes, running into hundreds of millions. In fact, there was a modelling done on a near miss of a storm in Ireland a number of years back, and they found that had it tracked over the east coast of Ireland, it just narrowly missed, we would have looked at €1.1 billion in damage. So that's how severe these storms are. And again, anyone who's a little bit older will remember, yes, we've had storms in the past. The difference now is we're getting more of them and they're more powerful and they're coming in and they're dumping more energy. And we know that because they're rolling in off warmer seas, and the engine of storminess is the heat engine is drawn from the ocean. So we've got 7 to 10% more moisture in the air. That again is the ammunition for intense downpours. So put it all together and what you have is a sort of a, if you'll pardon the phrase, a perfect storm in terms of risk. And the important thing to really say here is, what does this mean for people? You know, if you're one of those 100,000 homes that's at risk of basically inundation, right? What that means is, let's say that you have flood insurance and your home unfortunately is inundated. Right, the chances are that the insurance company will pay out, but they will never pay again. You will lose flood insurance. What does that mean? That means what happens to your mortgage?
Will you become uninsurable?
You effectively become uninsurable. So there's massive risks. And we're talking about risks running into tens of billions of having huge amounts of our housing stock effectively uninsurable. So these are the kind of things that we need to be watching super careful, because without a functioning insurance and reinsurance market, well, then the housing market is the next thing to go. Because all the new housing that we need to build in Ireland, unless the companies providing the finance can be certain that the asset that they're lending against is a secure asset, in other words, it's not going to end up underwater, effectively, their loans are no good. So we have to be super careful here that in the rush, for example, to get new housing, which we all know we need, we've got to make sure that we're building it in the right way, but most importantly, in the right places.
Well, naturally, areas, because I looked at some of the just the numbers around Dublin particularly, and Dublin 1, Dublin 3, which you see plenty of cranes and lots of construction happening in the north inner city at the moment. There's high demand for not just housing, but also for commercial premises around that area. These seem to be some of the areas that are most at risk.
That's right. And we see the risk areas, as you said, Dublin 1, 3, 13. I mentioned already the East Wall, the Docklands, right along the mouth of the Liffey. We're also looking at risks extending all the way up to County Louth, including, of course, Howth Head. And we also have a lot of low-lying areas around Sutton and Marino as well that are at great risk of coastal inundation. And again, to explain why these are so dangerous, As sea levels rise and storms become more powerful, what you get are storm surges that might reach 3, and in the West Coast up to 5 metres. Now, 5 metres in old money, you're looking at a wall of 17 feet of additional sea level coming at you, right, during that storm event. And that's, you can see with that how quickly defences can be breached, defences overtopped, and massive damage on the other side. So I suppose the issue here is, first of all, we really need to be talking about this far more. We need to get, for example, making sure that the OPW, what are their projections for sea level rise this century? Are those projections sufficiently pessimistic? Because, of course, in the insurance business, you need to be a pessimist. You must look at the worst case scenarios and you must plan for them. There's no good saying, well, you know, we thought it would hold, but it's all collapsed. We have to plan for worst case scenarios. And what we're seeing, Will, is that these worst case scenarios, they're coming at us faster and harder than ever before.
Okay, and just for anyone who thinks that this is a case of you're looking at, say, research from the 70s or 80s, essentially this is a comparison to 5-6 years ago, I think, when they did the last survey. So it's actually relatively recent and it shows more homes being built in these potentially flood-affected areas. The Irish natural environment. So we've had an EU analysis of basically Irish water, which hasn't come back very positively. And they have found poor quality of natural waters, particularly in this new environmental survey that's come out.
That's right. This is a really large-scale survey carried out by the European Environmental Agency. Now, these studies are published every 5 years. So the last one was just around COVID time in 2020. And what it found in the case of Ireland, so they do a drill down, and if you go to their website, you can go in and you can select the country of choice, say Ireland, for example, and they will drill in to the particular environmental indicators to see how we're doing. Bottom line is they're saying that nature in Ireland is in a very poor state. And they're saying that our economic growth, which is true and which has delivered obviously many benefits for the population, it has been primarily achieved at the cost of our natural environment. So we have failed to decouple economic growth from environmental damage. That's the critical thing really taken home. Breaking that down, as you said, we have very serious issues with our waterways, our inland waterways, our estuaries, our lakes are not improving. You hear lots of people on the radio telling you that they are, or telling you, just give us a couple more years, we'll turn this around. We've been hearing that now for the last 10 years. So, and again, the EEA report is saying that improvement is not happening. And taking it across nature as a whole, they're saying that 85% of Ireland's protected habitats, now they're not talking about the unprotected habitats, these are our so-called protected habitats, are in an unfavourable status, right? And they're also saying that a third of protected species of flora and fauna are also in an unfavourable status. So these are really horrible statistics, and probably all the more so because Ireland has made a point internationally of trading on its green reputation. We go to international markets and we promote a concept called Origin Green. We say, look, we're this green, clean country. Buy our produce because we produce it in an environmentally friendly way. We work with nature, buy our produce. Now, unfortunately, the data is being very unhelpful with that narrative. And it's really important that the people who are promoting these, which often include government ministers, that they need to get a reality check, Will. They need to start, instead of hyping up a non-existent environmental utopia that we do not have here, what we need to do instead is to get real about environmental regulation that actually works to protect the environment. And when I say the environment, people sometimes think I'm talking about, you know, frogs and newts and snails and stuff. The environment, the living environment, is where we all have to live. So environmental damage, the costs imposed on society by environmental damage are absolutely enormous. And we're seeing this time and time again. And unfortunately, as I say, despite what we hear from all these lobbyists and all these spokespeople, The indicators do not lie. And again, we're not spending here, Will. For example, across the EU, we know the average countries are spending about 2.2% of GDP is spent on environmental protection. In Ireland, it's less than 1%. So we do not put our money where our mouth is. What we put our money into is developing marketing campaigns, telling people that we're doing a great job. So we greenwash. We're among the world leaders in greenwash. Mm. But what we do not see is strong investment in environmental protection. And I will hazard to suggest that the reason for that is that if you have strong environmental protection, you're trotting on a lot of toes, a lot of people making a lot of money doing a lot of environmental damage. We see, for example, they were specific. This is the environmental agency saying, quote, the intensification of livestock farming in response to ambitious growth policies, and these, of course, are government policies, has contributed to increased environmental degradation. And again, no decoupling here. More pollution, more intensification, more production, more intensification, more damage. And the question really is the Irish taxpayer, you know, we're the ones taking the hit on this, and the Irish public in the broader sense. And I think we need to be far more critical of the social license that has been given to these groups, individuals and sectors who are profiting while damaging the wider environment.
Yeah, probably no great surprise as well as the line in there about car dependency and the fact that there's
absolutely
investment.
Yeah, we have a whole bunch of things across the report. As you said, we have excessive car dependency. We're seeing, for example, that our public transport, yes, we've had some investment in it over the last few years, but not enough. And we're seeing, Will, of course, with the current government, a lot of backsliding on a lot of the promises and commitments. For example, the 2-to-1 share of public to private transport. We're seeing that being rowed back on. We're seeing a lot of walking away from some of the positive environmental progress that was made, say, since 2020. And it really, the public, need to say, we need to insist that our politicians hold the line on this.
Just before we finish, I've been reading a bit about Jane Goodall since she passed away yesterday, age of 91. My memory was that she was in a terrible episode of The Simpsons, not her fault. It was just a really, really bad episode where the monkeys were going out into the mine. But I have been reading a bit about her, and it seems a quite remarkable life. You know, a woman who grew up on the south coast in the UK, always had this great interest in animals and a great interest particularly in primates, and ultimately would give her life towards that, but also was about much more than just the life of primates. She actually ended up really, really interested in conserving the world towards the end of her life as well.
That's right. I think she's really one of the most remarkable individuals in the environmental movement, in the broader environmental movement, certainly in the last half century and more. I love this anecdote, by the way, from her, that she told about her own childhood. When she was a small child, one day she was so curious to know where eggs came from that she hid herself for several hours in the hen house to try to find out. And her mother, she was gone so long, her mother called the police, right? And she said that obviously she had a burning desire to understand. And that is the hallmark of science. And the kind of science that people like Jane Goodall do, it's incredibly selfless. It involves placing yourself in nature for weeks, months, years at a time. So she, as a primatologist, she studied, her specialty, of course, was chimpanzees. Mm. And she studied them, she lived with them, she got their confidence. And these are, chimpanzees are known to be quite aggressive, mind you, so are humans. But she lived successfully in chimpanzee communities, and she changed our view of the primates as if, I guess, of course, humans are also part of, we're also primates. And so she changed our view of our fellow primates. And what we know as well is that they have complex societies. For example, the chimpanzees are, they make and use tools, because many of the human conceits that we're the only ones who do these things. Her painstaking research involving literally living her life with the chimpanzees was able to provide hard empirical evidence that has greatly improved our understanding, not just of primates, but also of natural systems. And you're absolutely right, Will. Her closeness to nature later in her life, rather like David Attenborough, she came to realize that the whole system that she was studying is under assault right across the world. Ecosystems are collapsing, deforestation is spreading, climate change is rendering many of these habitats, basically destroying them. And she became an advocate for strong both climate action and environmental protection, and she will be greatly missed.
John Gavin-Smith, thanks for joining us on the show.
The Last Word on Today FM.